God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Brent. Good to be with you.
Likewise, mate. How are you?
Yeah, good. Yeah, enjoying the footy finals and a day at the races yesterday, plus the busy parliamentary week. Yeah, we've got another one coming up.
The pages began beeping just after 3:30 Tuesday afternoon in Lebanon, alerting Hezbollah operatives to a message from their leadership in a chorus of chimes, melodies and buzzes. But it wasn't the militants' leaders. The pages had been sent by Hezbollah's arch-enemy. And within seconds, the alerts were followed by the sounds of explosions and cries of pain and panic in streets, shops and homes across Lebanon. By the end of the day, and it was only day one, at least a dozen people were dead and more than 2,700 were wounded, many of them maimed. It was just absolutely horrible, wasn't it, Mark?
Well, it's probably the most amazing non-combat military strike in history. Yes, it was devastating for the victims of it, but also incredibly effective from an Israeli point of view in their war against terrorism. They do have a problem not just with Gaza and Hamas, but Lebanon and the bombing and the strikes of Hezbollah, very often funded by Iran. And a significant development was that the Iranian ambassador to Lebanon was carrying one of these pages. So we found out a bit more about that relationship, but you'd have to say the Israeli intelligent Mossad to pull this off is just stunning. The reaction that I found around Parliament House last week as people talked about it was amazement and admiration for the Israeli intelligence services, and then the next day they exploded the walkie-talkie. So you'd have to think whether it's Hamas or Hezbollah or Islamic State terrorists, they're looking at all their electronic devices now, thinking they're not safe. And it's not just the impact in the people that have been killed and hospitalised. They've effectively disabled the entire communications network of these terrorists because they don't know what's about to explode next. So it's an incredible moment in military history, and Israel in this fight against Hamas, Hezbollah and other terrorists, it's been a masterstroke.
I see the Australian government updated its advice on the Smart Traveller site for Lebanon yesterday. It said Australians in Lebanon have been told to leave immediately while commercial flights remain available as the latest Israeli attacks on Hezbollah fuel fears, of course, Mark, of an all-out war. We just don't know what's around the corner here.
Well, that's the next thing, isn't it? Escalation after the intelligence strikes through the pages and the walkie-talkies at various times since the terrorist attack on Israel on the 7th of October. Israel's struck back and killed some of the key commanders against it. And there's always been talk, oh, well, this will escalate into a more conventional full-scale war rather than the Israeli invasion of Gaza. We didn't see that. All those predictions didn't really come about. Will the incredible attacks that we saw this week lead to an escalation? Again, we've got to wait and see. But you tend to think, how long can this go on without Lebanon, Iran and other militant terrorist-type countries in the Middle East engaging in full-scale war against Israel? I think the advice of the Australian government to get out of there is pretty good advice for any Australian citizen.
Trump has said that in the first day, if he's elected president, he'll stop these wars. Do you really think the bloke's got a plan to do this? Do you think he'll have any success? Or is it just campaign rhetoric?
Well, I think it's more rhetorical than anything else. Day one, if it's such a great plan, he should make it public and urge the current administration to implement it. I don't know if he thinks he can do it by force of personality or he knows something from his 4 years as president. But, you know, my own view in the Middle East is that countries like Syria, Lebanon, what's happening in Gaza, Iran, to some extent they need the Israelis. I mean, the easiest way for those dictatorships to remain in place is to ensure that there's someone to hate other than their local government. their domestic government. So they use the Israelis always as a straw man to point hate and evil towards Israel. And those Middle Eastern countries are never really serious about solving the Palestinian question. You know, countries like Jordan could contribute land and the like. They never do that because they need the Israelis to hate, because it keeps their own people hating Israel rather than the domestic government of that country. So, yeah, I think that's a big factor in the Middle East, why basically we'll never really get a lasting peace.
True. True. Sad but true. Sad but true.
It's very sad and true. And for Israel, it's a permanent state of being under siege, permanent state of being surrounded by their enemies.
Albo hasn't had a great week. He's OS at the moment, but earlier in the week he pushed back against accusations that his government is strangling Australian businesses with red tape. He told a dinner with executives from some of the country's biggest firms that Labor is proudly pro-business and pro-worker.
Well, sometimes you can't be both. You know, he's trying to walk both sides of the street in an industrial dispute, and the industrial relations changes he's made. How can you be both pro-business and pro-worker? So I think that's pretty cheap rhetoric from someone having an each-way bet. They call him each-way Albo every now and then, and this is an instance of it. Pretty significant, though, that the Mining Council leadership and the Business Council leadership have made some direct pointed criticisms of the government. That hasn't happened for a while. They've been pretty patient with the Labor government. It's been in for the last couple of years. Where has the business leadership been? I mean, one of the things we talk about in politics is that the business leadership in Australia seems more interested in climate change, hurting their own financial interests, diversity, employment, woke agenda, all the virtues signalling again, nothing to do with their financial bottom line, that the big business leadership in Australia had lost the plot. So at least this week they've come back to basics and made some fundamental points that the Albanese government's not very good for mining with a lot of their environmental rulings, and in industrial relations they're not good for any business in Australia with the patent bargaining and also that ruling that you can't contact your staff out of hours. So, it's about time the business leaders in these peak councils actually did their job and stood up to the government and called out a few home truths.
Mark, it's small business too, though. I mean, you get around, I get around. I've been a small businessman for, you know, nearly 40 years, and I've got to say there are so many other small business people that we talk to as part of our day-to-day business that have never seen things so bad. And I mean that. I'm not expanding that or trying to make it sound worse than it is, but these are some of the comments that small business people are saying at the moment. I mean, they've never seen it so bad in all of the years that they've been doing business.
Oh, yeah, I don't dispute that. I hear that myself, Brent, from small business. What I was talking about earlier was the leadership of these big business peak bodies like the Business Council of Australia, the Minerals Council. These are funded by the biggest companies in Australia. Small business has been lost in the debate, of course, but the big business groups have been pretty silent about the sins of the Albanese government. But this week at last, you know, they put the gloves on and had a crack, which was good to see. And small business associations, is it COSBOA, the small business group, where are they echoing the sort of thing you've just mentioned?
Yeah.
What can happen with these small and big business associations? They go to dinners with the ministers, they have meetings with them, they don't want to upset the ministers and be denied access, so they soft pedal. You know, they sort of get incorporated into the system. They enjoy the limelight but don't really do their job. And this week, at long last, they've at least had a crack.
Better late than never, I suppose you could say.
Well, it's very late. It's very late in the scene. You know, right from the beginning of COVID onwards, whether you're talking Morrison government or this government, the business conditions have been appalling. A lot of the decisions of government have been blatantly anti-business. Where has the leadership of the business sector been?
Unions have dropped their threats of industrial action on Sydney's rail network, allowing tens of thousands of footy fans to attend the final games to travel without interruptions this weekend. The threats came earlier this week as pay negotiations between the government, the New South Wales government, and the rail, tram and bus union stalled.
Well, it's a complex dispute. There's a pay claim there by the rail union, but Brent, I think it's mainly about the emerging importance of metro trains in Sydney.
Right.
The former Berejiklian and Perrottet government under Minister Andrew Constance, he would openly say The Liberal Party likes the metro system because it's got driverless trains. No drivers means no trade unions to have to deal with in getting the trains running. So metro has become bigger in Sydney, and there's a plan to even convert a heavy rail line from Sydenham to Bankstown to metro at enormous public expense. The Liberals wanted to do that just to get rid of the drivers. Well, incredibly now, the Minns government seems to have agreed that driverless trains on the metro will have staff.
Right.
As a way of pacifying the union, is obviously they want drivers and staff because it means union membership. And the Liberals were against that. Well, the Labor government is now saying the train can be, the metro train can be driverless, but there'll be someone on there to help with safety and advice to passengers. Well, it was never designed that way, and it just seems to me the biggest cave-in to the rail unions that you've ever seen. Isn't that just incredible? Driverless train. It purchased and operated at taxpayer expenses, driverless, are going to have staff, apparently, as the Minns Labor government caves into the trade union.
Well, it's just to pacify them, really.
Pacify them, yeah. I don't know how, but apparently the union had, the rail union had a veto on whether or not the Sydenham to Bankstown line would be converted to metro. And all these issues have been on the table. They've been subject to these disputes. It is pretty complex, but we're at the point now where the wage claim seems to be secondary to the whole question of can the union maintain its numbers and its membership in the era of the metro train, which is supposed to be driverless.
The Minns government's got another problem. It raised its head late in the week. The $300 million redevelopment of Penrith Stadium, it's hit a hurdle as the Minns government, fights an Aboriginal land claim over the site. Mark?
Well, it's ridiculous to think that a football stadium that's been there, in my knowledge, well, since the 1950s, could be subject to an Aboriginal land claim now solely for the reason that it's going to be redeveloped. The whole project there has been controversial. The former government had a plan under the local minister, Stuart Ayres, to build the whole new football stadium for Penrith Panthers, who've won the last three comps, of course, so they're very popular up there in the marginal seat of Penrith. But they're going to take over the nearby Harness Racing Paceway and build the whole stadium there. At much greater expense. They had to buy the new Paceway, build the stadium and do something with the old one. The new Labor government plan has been, I think, just $300 million for a significant upgrade of the existing stadium for 2 years while the Panthers go play down the road at Combank. So that's been the background to it. But the idea that a land council could say they've now got a claim and continuous usage rights of a football stadium is just absurd. All these things should be automatically dismissed, but they become such a blockage in the system for sensible development, like the gold mine we were talking about at Blaney a few weeks ago, and now a football stadium at Penrith. The rules should respect the Mabo judgment that, yes, land rights exist in Australia, but there's got to be continuous use and affinity of the Indigenous to that land. And obviously something's being used, a football stadium, is not Indigenous land.
Speaking of the gold mine at Blaney, there seems to be so much evidence stacking up against the decision made by Tanya Plibersek. I mean, we've had Chris Minns come out and say it should go ahead. We've had the Prime Minister come out and almost contradict his own minister, saying it should go ahead, I want it to go ahead. But so far, nothing's changed.
It hasn't gone ahead. No. Who's running these government? Who's running the federal government when the Prime Minister says he wants it to go ahead, but his Environment Minister is not listening and openly disrespecting his point of view? And I was talking to a New South Wales minister about it during the week. If you pass through all the hoops of environmental assessment in New South Wales, and Minns himself has said there's dozens of them, if you jump through all those hoops and get an approval, well, it's a pretty solid development on environmental grounds that the federal government shouldn't be touching. So, you know, it ticks all the boxes. This is the frustration for people who want to invest in our state. You can tick all the boxes, go through an extensive process to get your approval, but there's some ridiculous argument elsewhere in the system that holds you up. This is what's happening at Blaney. It's happening to the gas project up there at Narrabri. I mean, these things, for Santos at Narrabri, they've been delayed 7 or 8 years. I mean, you wonder why investment goes overseas. Have a look at some of these case studies where it's an absolute nightmare for the applicant.
I see that the Treasurer, Mr. Chalmers, hasn't ruled out a double dissolution election as the Senate delayed passing Federal Labor's key housing legislation. On Wednesday of this week, the Coalition, the Greens and the Independent Senators deferred the debate in the Senate for 2 months on Labor's Help to Buy legislation. So now we've got the threat of the double dissolution election. Empty threats, Mark?
Yeah, I think so. The problem for Labor with the double dissolution election is that they get further away from controlling the Senate, because the quota for election becomes lower and the minor parties get more people elected. So it's not an answer to getting things through the Senate to just dissolve both houses in their entirety instead of having a half-Senate election as scheduled. And this housing stuff, I'm not too sure is ever going to deliver much for Australia, an argument about social housing. Most people just want to buy a house, and the affordability issues there are now off the radar, and the federal government should be trying to fix private housing affordability as much as they can. And of course, the main sin of Jim Chalmers is his fight with the Reserve Bank, where the Reserve Bank says that federal government big spending means that interest rates can't come down.
Well, you know, interest rates have come down. That was the big news. The federal this week with America, they have dropped their interest rates. Even dropping their interest rates, they're still higher than what our interest rates are here in Australia. But all the talk this week has been, does this mean, is this a sign that the RBA are going to start to drop interest rates here in Australia? A lot of economists, Mark, are saying 0.25% interest rate drop before Christmas.
Well, the Reserve Bank's not saying that. They had a message that interest rates will be steady for quite some time, but this is the Australian problem. We're against the trend. Overseas, inflation is retreating and interest rates are coming down, but in Australia there's no sign of that. And the Reserve Bank Governor has consistently said New South Wales, Victorian and federal budget deficits are just way too big, inflating the economy, pumping it up, adding to inflationary pressures and making the job of interest rate cuts a lot harder for the Reserve Bank. So I don't think we'll have a cut by the end of the year. They want inflation to come down, and there's little sign of that at the moment. You know, the Australian situation is a lot worse than the rest of the world.
The headline came out later this week, or later week just gone, Albanese under fire as migrant intake blows forecasts. Australia's migrant intake, it's going to exceed 400,000 for the last financial year, and that blows the federal government's chances of meeting its target. Peter Dutton, of course, he's condemned the Prime Minister for failing to manage population growth during a housing crisis. Gee, the numbers have gone through the roof, Mark, haven't they, in reference to immigration?
Well, there's your housing affordability problem right there.
Yeah.
A massive increase in demand from huge numbers of overseas migrants means, obviously, where are they going to live? And if they come here to buy a house, they're competing against Australians that are already here, and the prices go up, and our big cities are far less affordable. So 400,000 is just a ridiculous number. The historic trend in Australia is we're a lot better off if the inflation numbers are about 70 to 100. Thousand, that's manageable, but the big Australia immigration numbers, that somehow our country, where most people live on the coast, the soils are fragile, the carrying capacity of the country is environmentally limited, our cities can only sprawl so far, you know, we just can't sustain the big numbers. You can look at Australian map and think, oh, they can take a lot more people. But the reality, particularly in the big cities, is that these huge migration numbers drive up housing prices. They do, to some extent, take some jobs off Australians. And in the university sector, of course, they've caused huge problems with the vast number of overseas students studying there. They don't add to the permanent migration numbers. But I think there's a stat that one in every three people living in this country right now is a foreign student, which again adds to the housing affordability problems, particularly in rental.
It sure does. I see again the Prime Minister said on Wednesday that the Australian Government and the ARL Commission, we're going to talk about footy finals shortly, but this story came out on Wednesday, that the Government and the ARL Commission were at the pointy end of securing this $600 million funding deal for PNG to enter the competition. They said it was most likely in 2028, of course, as the 19th team. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it just strikes me as ridiculous. Now, maybe there's some foreign policy argument, and they love their rugby league in Papua New Guinea, and maybe it's a good foreign policy measure to combat Chinese influence because they don't play rugby league, and all of that kind of sounds comical. But Brent, they're going to play this team in Cairns. You know, the idea is to build a football stadium in Cairns in North Queensland, and that's where PNG plays the competition because, you know, the instability and law and order issues in Port Moresby mean that you couldn't be bringing rugby league teams there every second week. So I don't know the sense in how it can really be a PNG team if it's based out of Cairns in Queensland. Well, why not call it a Far North Queensland team? Have some PNG players, maybe a focus, you know, trial games in Port Moresby and promotional stuff. But it just, to me, sounds wrong as a rugby league supporter that you can have a team that's not actually based where the name indicates it should be.
Yeah, that's true. Very true.
Well, the administrators and all the management's in Port Moresby.
That's right.
And they can't play in Port Moresby because of the security reasons. Well, I'm sorry, you can't have a team.
And you can't have your $600 million.
And you can't have, they're going to give it to them, plus the cost. Cairns hasn't got a football stadium at the moment. They've got to build that as well.
The Storm, the headline today I was reading this morning brought back memories for me. The Storm broke Rod Wishart. Then there's a blast from the past. Broke Rod Wishart's heart in 1999. Now his son, God, we're all getting old, is setting out to make things right. Yeah, Rod Wishart, of course, is Illawarra Steelers royalty. Illawarra Steelers, I suppose, Dragons royalty. Now his son, Tyron, is 160 minutes away from potentially winning an NRL premiership with the Storm. That's something Rod Wishart couldn't do back in 1999 with the Illawarra Steelers.
Well, it's a nightmare to remember. As an old Dragons supporter in 1999, the Dragons had that game locked up. We were well ahead at half time. Anthony Mundine dropped the ball over the line. We would have been unbeatable. And then the Storm came back and won with that controversial penalty try in the final seconds of the game. And Wishart was on the wing. Rod Wishart was on the wing for the Dragons. So it was a nightmare for him, but also the supporters. I can tell you, Brent, it's 25 years ago, and I hope Tyron Wishart can succeed, but he's doing it for the Storm, who broke our hearts those 25 years ago. You know, a lot of Dragons supporters say Tyron was a pretty good local junior in the Illawarra. How did we ever let him go?
Yeah, Roosters to face the Storm in the preliminary final. It's they've booked their spot in the 2024 preliminary finals. God, they whacked Manly, didn't they? 40-16.
Yeah, they did, and the other game wasn't competitive either. The Sharks were ahead of the Cowboys 24-0 at half time, so that was all over. The two rugby league semis this weekend have been non-events from a spectator point of view, and on Friday night the rugby league was embarrassed. They only had 19,000 for the Sharks-Cowboys game at Allianz, and right next door at the SCG it was full for the Swans defeating Port Adelaide in front of 44,000 fans. It was a bit of a competition to see which is the popular football code in Sydney, and the AFL won 2-1. And the AFL games this week, I don't know if you saw the Lions game against Geelong last night, but another sensational match. The Lions, who easily beat Carlton and then had a miracle comeback against GWS last night, had another miracle comeback and go through to the grand final. So AFL, for excitement value at least, is producing a lot more than the rugby league at the moment.
It sure is, yeah. Let's hope that changes next weekend at least. All right, Mark, thank you, mate. Always good to talk to you on a Sunday morning. We appreciate you spending the time with us. Have a good week. You've got a busy week in Parliament.
Yeah, a week coming up with a whole bunch of important stuff. So we'll get through that and talk next Sunday. Look forward to it.
Thanks, mate. See you, Mark. Bye-bye.